I'll call you right back.
Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio Radio, your source for the alternative viewpoint to the news around you. In between the amazing shows here, I invite you to check out Rock Soul Radio, the latest source for alternative music and metaphysical talk on the web. Click over to rocksoulradio.com or find us on the Live 365 mobile app by searching Rocked Soul Radio. That's Rocked, R-O-C-K-D, Soul Radio.
Well, good evening and welcome to Feed Your Happiness. This is Indigo. Yeah. Once I discovered these guys. Anyway, tonight, in spite of Mercury being retrograde, we think we're all set now. We have Ken Withrow. Hello, Ken. Ken? Okay, you are so broken up. I don't know what to do. Okay, why don't you hang up and let me just, I'll put some more music on and I'm going to try to call you and see if it works any better. And we're going to listen to some more of Indigo Dam Unip while I try to call him.
Much better?
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yeah. It's been kind of weird reception out here today. I had to go sit in a car outside.
Okay. Yeah, that's not the first time. We've had people go out. My friend in Georgia was in Alabama freezing, and she had to go outside and get in the truck. It's like, okay, you know, whatever. And Mercury being retrograde doesn't really help this any.
No, it doesn't at all. I've been finding that a lot of stuff's been like synchronistically in line, but it seems like little simple things have not been working well. And I think we got another week of that.
Yes, we do, until next Sunday, the 17th. There might still be a couple days of residual mess afterwards. So, at least more days. But anyway, I'm so glad you're here. I want to say you're from, you live in Valparaiso, Indiana. You are from there now. Actually, you're from Northern California, and you came out this way over 20 years ago. What brought you to... I mean, from the San Francisco area to industrial smog infested northern Indiana, not too far from Chicago. What got you up here?
Well, I was art major at Santa Cruz and woke up one day going, I could pay anyone to teach me this, and more than likely the best artists learn from life anyways, so what do I want to do? And I had a penchant for biology, so I switched majors from art to biology and physics, and then got an offer for free room and board out here in Indiana to go to Purdue. And there you go. I literally made the decision and move within a week.
Wow.
It was just weird. And I had no clue what I was getting into. I just moved out here. And the tour I got, which was awful, was all the industrial areas on the left, Barry and Hammond.
Yeah.
So I was just like, I can't believe I just did this, you know? And then as I got settled into school, I saw a lot of people in real life.
Yeah.
But with the seasons and, you know, and then drop anchor and get into life and back.
Sure, I like that, yeah.
It's, I like it out here a lot. So I just kind of stayed.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm in Illinois. I grew up in Illinois, but I've lived around the country. But I've been back in Illinois for quite a while now, and I like it. It may not be my final place.
But, yeah.
You know, there's a lot going on. And the one thing about Illinois and Indiana is we've got tons of wind farms. At least we're picking up on that kind of thing.
It's really exploding on not just the wind farms, but from green energy in general and green agriculture. Like, people really, they're very open-minded right now to ideas. I think it's farmer country.
Opening. Well, you know, there's been things happening, and then we've talked before, and the shift, everything has, you know, people are waking up to more and more. And you yourself, you are the, like, founder and chief of operations and production at Green Farms A&M, and this can be found on Facebook. It's just Green Farms A&M.
Yeah, Green Farms A&M on Facebook, and then our website, which about it is www.greenfarmsam.com, and that. You know, it that gives a really nice explanation of everything we're about and our systems, and gives some good photos. And I know that we have been working on the website and upgrading, so we got a bunch of new newspaper articles put out for us, and some did a TV spot. Oh God, I can't remember when, a local station,
but no. Yeah,
it's been picking up. So I like sending people the Facebook we use to do the posting, daily posting, you know, like, hey, you know, there's new prices on microgreens or whatever. But the website's like that's kind of the hub of really getting to know what we do, what we're about, what we're trying to do, you know.
Yeah. Well, now you even though you were pretty nerdy when you got into biology and the physics, bioengineering and all this at Purdue, you hadn't really grown anything, had you? I mean, how did you start growing?
That I kind of fell into on accident. I'm not the best at growing things. I have a great horticulturist around me. I get how to do it. But it's a patience. It's a lot of work. And, you know, it's a patience issue. You know, it's a matter of being meticulous.
Yeah.
And knowing the system, you know, anyone who's grown anything gets that. And what happened was, I have a lot of kids. I have five boys, and I was working at the mill, running a water treatment plant, and it just got expensive. And so I wanted to grow food for the family, and then that's when I got really into organic farming, you know, heirloom seeds and all that stuff. And I just nerded out on it again, you know, and just kind of was like, you know, if I could do this, I could do this much more efficiently, and I could do it, you know, indoors. And it just kind of, it escalated from, you know, growing some herbs in the window to a full-on automated, utility-free aquaponic produce farm. And I brought friends in, and, you know, my present partners, and we started really working on this. 3 years later, we ended up with what we have now, which, you know, that we have, I would call our prototype. It's an active farm we've worked in the market solid for a year with clients, and you know, like we're actually right now getting ready to expand. I'm raising money to put up a new building and facility. I've been working on that for about 2 weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
And we will quadruple the size of our farm.
Wow.
To take on the clientele demand that we've had, that we couldn't fill the orders, the people bugging us. So we decided it was time to bump it up.
Yeah. Well, how did you first start out after you had a little bit more than you needed to feed 5 growing boys? Then what did you just call up, go into some restaurant, diners, and say, hey, you know, we've got this? Or was it organized?
The way we started was the first prototype was literally 2 card tables stacked on top of each other with shop lights and domes and trays growing microgreens. We just wanted to do an indoor microgreen farm on a very small scale. We built this room, which was basically, I took a room in the back of my barn and I encased it in plastic, and then we cut up a 2-room tent, so we had a double zipper door, so that we had kind of a clean room style environment.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to try and grow microgreens with no pesticides around or anything, and see like how, you know, it was like the generic of the idea. And then we sold those to a restaurant out in southern Michigan called Fitzgerald's, and they helped us along, really. They were great people. And we did that for about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then we built a better version of it and bumped it up a little more and grew a few more things. And then we decided to do the prototype of the architecture component of our farm idea, which we took about 150 tires and built a room inside the barn out of tires, and then encased it in plastic inside and out. And those tires were stuffed with basically garbage, non-compostable garbage, like, you know, old plastic, insulation, anything and everything that could hold heat. And so, like, it was a pseudo-hermetically sealed room and inside of a big building. And then we basically used a couple space heaters, and we started the initial farm, first version of what we have now, which was made out of plywood coated in boat resin. We made all these big troughs and started buying our lights and started part, you know, using the fish to produce the nutrients. We, you know, started working a lot of the cons and doing a lot of testing and developing the idea. And once we finally decided on the next components, that's when we went and built the version we have right now. Built a good room, got rid of the tires. We got an investor. She threw us a very large sum of money and helped us out tremendously, you know, and got us up and rolling with an active farm, and went out.
Well, yeah, right.
Walked in the doors of restaurants. Girl.
Well, the investors have come from just people that you talked to, or people who saw you on TV, or who read the article. Probably all of those, or.
Well, the investors I'm talking to now have been across the board. You know, I used to flip houses in Gary, Indiana, and I'm really used to shopping for investors. It's a job in itself that I got pretty good at. So I would basically read articles, go through line, thing and everything, and try and get to know who's who out there in the business world was remotely connected or directly connected to our business.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would just run around pitching this concept and that we needed investors. And you know, turned investors down. We had, you know, just come to us, but with not enough. I drove all the way up to Detroit to meet with some. We had people fly out from California to to meet with us.
That's where
we ended up with. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, at this point, like you had mentioned earlier, I mean, because with people waking up and becoming more aware, at least people are interested, where you don't have to pitch it from the get-go. You may have to pitch the way you're doing it or whatever, but they're aware that this is...
I'm not, like, outright selling the idea. They were looking for something, which was how the lady we got now, our present investor that got us, you know, our initial, she's a full-on partner, man. She's been through thick and thin with us. She lived right here in town, and we had bumped into each other through mutual friends, and when I was doing stuff with Occupy, and we just kind of volunteered on the farm, helped out, got this, and she sort of was seeking us out while I was out shopping for investors, and she offered it to me. I didn't see it coming. It was great. And I mean, it's just a fabulous person. 100% behind everything we're doing. And she got us what we needed to have something that I could pitch to do, you know, the next batch of investors. And it's kind of, there's some that have been watching us this whole time and been waiting for us to ask. And then some that were newfound, you know, they came out of class. Just very wide array of people. But the funny thing, which you just said, is they were all ready for this.
Yeah.
They wanted to be part of this. It's not just the farming. They wanted to be part of where the world's going. They wanted to be actively involved in the race, you know?
Yeah.
Part of the change. And they're doing it, buying our produce, investing in the, you know, in the farm. I mean, I got people buying my lettuce that don't even need it. Just say they were there, and they roll in with the rest of their stuff. I got a guy, George's Euros in Chesterton. There is no healthy food in here. He will tell you left and right. That's not what it's about. You know, I sell hot dogs. I sell, you know, greasy food. And I really like you guys and what you're doing, and we eat good at home. Nobody wants to buy good food here, but he's like, but I'm going to sell your lettuce. And he started buying our lettuce, and he rolls it in with his other lettuce. He normally uses just Iceberg, but he's like, he loved it. And so he just wanted to be part of the whole machine, you know?
I love it. Somebody
who has
such unhealthy other food, but
lettuce. Yeah. He has no need for our lettuce in that place. Nobody even notices that they just ate like a spicy spring mix mixed in with their salad. They don't even know. And he's just like, I just want it here, you know? And what was weird was I was driving, when I go to out for new clients, I scout the town, make a big list of all the restaurants, walk in, ask to talk to the manager or chef, and if I could book an appointment. And then I come back with sample, and usually 3-4 visits before I get a bite.
Okay.
I walked in, and the dude immediately, I had samples on me, and it was just a whim. I'm just a gut feeling. I walk in there, and within 20 minutes, he's like, I want this. How soon can I get 2 pounds from you a week? He ended up bumping it up, too. He, like, started filling more.
Yeah, and I was going to say for listeners who really aren't aware, you know, 2 pounds of lettuce, the greens that you
That's get, a lot.
It's a lot, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because we're not talking about some kind of iceberg lettuce. We're talking about real greens.
Yeah,
and
real greens.
A lot to, even do 2 pounds. So,
average restaurant goes through 10 to 20, we'll say, averaging usually around 16 pounds a week of lettuce in an average restaurant. So you think of the patrons going through the place. Now, he does about 20 pounds of iceberg. He's buying 4 pounds of our lettuce just to fluff it in there so he could say, job.
He's doing it.
Yeah, he's not hurting his wallet. That's small of an increment. But if he bought more because icebergs so dirt cheap, you know, and so he's like, but I want to be part of this. And this guy.
No, that well, that's what.
No connection to this kind of food.
A little bit at a time. Now, you've
exactly.
talked about lettuce and greens. Is that basically what you're growing, Ken? I mean, are you
right,
doing any?
We're doing lettuce, and wheatgrass.
Okay, lettuce, wheatgrass, and what?
Lettuce, microgreens, and wheatgrass. Now the lettuce is it's a spring mix. We have we just moved arugula into it too, but we have romaine and some red oak, frisée. You know, it's a mix, and we actually are trying different mixes too. And then we grow specialty mixes for restaurants, like Asian blends and spicy blends.
Yeah.
And
okay.
We're really pushing to the microgreen market and to turn people on to baby herbs and microgreens. Mainly it's that we could really max variety system that we designed, and we can do more for the restaurant. So like one client, instead of just buying lettuce from us, I can have them buying four or five different, you know, crops. Like they could be buying their basil from us, you know, you name it. And then we've been getting into the wheatgrass market. We have come up with a way to grow wheatgrass that is coming out sweet and really dense, so people are getting quite the bang for their buck. And they get it live, which is really cool. So they, you know, I mean, it's the way you want to do wheatgrass. You cut it and masticate it in your juicer immediately.
Right. I used to work at one of the
juicer markets.
One of the nutrition stores I worked at had a juice bar, and they bought the wheatgrass in the flat and cut it. You know, when somebody ordered it, they just cut it, throw it in. Yeah, you want that fresh. But, I mean, you want everything as fresh as you can get it.
Yeah, live is always best because there's no degradation of the nutrients. And with wheatgrass, it degrades so quickly that you're literally just eating a bunch of, you know, chlorophyll and fiber if you don't, like, juice it immediately after cutting.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know if they still do, but there was a time when they were selling that in, some kind of cartons or of some, and it's just like, what are you doing? You know, that's just not even, shouldn't be on the board.
And people, you try and explain this, and a lot of people don't grasp it. You know, they just, you get a lot of bandwagons in the health, you know, realm.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a lot of bad ideas because they're so, and nowadays even more viral with the internet. So like it's even harder to, you know, once something, you know, takes off, if it's not right, you know, to correct it, it's very difficult.
Right, right. It's hard to.
Wheatgrass is one of them.
After it's gone round and round. Do your kids help in this endeavor?
I have only one of my boys is even remotely interested in helping me, and that's my 5-year-old likes to go on deliveries with me. He thinks it's really cool. I only take them on the local ones where it's a short trip because there's a lot of potty breaks and it starts to get really in the way of the deliveries. So, I'll take them on the short, quick ones. And most of the owners, especially in Valparaiso here in town, they all know us, my family and everyone, you know, 'cause all the business owners kind of know each other. So like, you know, when, my girlfriend walks in with our two youngest, they already make, you know, what Noah wants. Like at the coffee shop next to the juice bar, I'll take him on that delivery.
Yeah.
And they'll bring him back in the kitchen. You know, they know, you know, all my kids by name. So that one's fun, but, like, I won't take him on the big long routes. It's just insane. And my older boys, too busy with girls and basketball and life, you know, to care. And the baby is just, you don't bring the baby. It would just be absurd.
Baby, but well, and you want to get them when they're young, actually get them grubbing in the dirt because it seems to
do some
type of, the connection, and mm-hmm. connection. So
yeah, they love that. They like our the problem with my the main farm, the business farm, is that you have to go through a series of clean rooms to even get in there. So, like, you have to scrub down. We don't use pesticides. So, like, you have to scrub down like you're going into surgery to get into my farm. So, like, you know, two of my partners and the employee work in there pretty much. That's where they put all their time. And we have a room where I pick up the crops for delivery or, like, we got to meet and talk. But, like, to get into the farm, we really, you know, the only time I can freely go in and out of there is, like, right now, is we shut down half the farm to do overhaul and cleaning and stuff.
Hmm.
So I'm allowed to go in there then, but normally I'm not. I have to knock on the window and then they'll come up and talk to me, you know, but I can't get in.
Okay.
It's so my kids can't go in there. So, but we have a we have a family, like a house farm outside, and so
yeah.
all soil. And, you know, my last year, the kids and my girlfriend just planted pumpkins and cucumbers and tomatoes and trying to think what else, some corn and a bunch of other stuff, and did very well. You know, the deer only got to the corn,
okay.
But the rest of the crops made it.
Yeah, those deer, yeah.
They got long necks. You would think they were giraffes, you know. You put a good fence up, you plant it far enough away, and yet somehow they still seem to rip out what little you grew on those stalks.
Yeah.
And it's really aggravating. So we...
It is. It's not that you begrudge, you know, if you could grow a few rows just for them, that'd be fine. If they would stick to their rows.
Yeah, that's the tentative plan this year. We're doing a bunch of distractionary crops. And then I'm going to put the stuff, you know, like the corn we want to eat is going to go into the center of a larger fenced-in farm. And she won't do corn in the kid farm. The kid farm's going to, we're going to do more herbs. And, like, all her lettuce got robbed, man. They got to the lettuce. They took the corn. You know, I put a good fence up this time, but I'm sure they'll figure something out. They're smart. Those animals are very smart.
They're smart, yeah. But you know, we haven't been having such rough weather the last couple of years, so you would think that there would be other things but for them to, you know, eat. But so you've got this 10 acres, and since you have the deer, you're actually out of town a little bit.
Oh, yeah. We're I'm at the borderlands of suburbia and rural.
That's sort of nice. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm right at the edge. Like, there's one of the richest housing developments is right across the street from me, and I'm one of the last acreages of farmland before you get away from town. I'm like one of the last ones into town. So it's kind of a cool location because it's sort of like the neighbors. Before I got all this place, the last owner was considering turning it into like a little industrial park, you know, like with like shops and stuff. And they fought it to the core so that this place would stay, you know, rural. They wanted to have at least the look, you know. This is full of black walnut and pine trees, and it's a wooded farmland. There's probably 5 open acres and the rest is all woods.
Oh.
And, yeah, it's beautiful. So when I walked up, I wanted what the neighbors wanted, so it was a perfect fit.
Yeah. I'm glad. I mean, I'm sure that they're glad that they've got you there.
Oh, yeah, they're a lot happier. They weren't at first, though. I threw a bunch of very large parties to raise money for this farm. I did 8 of them, and I had, full-on hippie fest with bands and stuff, like, my band played.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, dude, I had people coming out from California all over, flying out here to these things. And the last party was 2 days with 500 people and tents all over the place. And that was it. I was just like, I can't do this again. My neighbors will string me up, you know. So we found, that's when I went on the hunt for investors, because we found raising the only way we knew how was not as good of an idea as it was during the parties themselves. And they were a blast, and they were great ideas during the parties. But when you get to the end, we really didn't raise much money. And all I did was tick off a couple real vital neighbors, and the rest of the neighbors all came out, you know. I mean, I had one neighbor, it was like a thing. They always would find out when the next party was, and the whole block behind my farm would all show up. All the adults would come out.
Well, that's good.
They'd bring,
as long as
they loved it.
Yeah.
Oh, it was great, yeah. Great PR for us.
Right, but it only took a couple to...
Yeah, two bad seeds.
Problem.
It took about a year to rectify the damage I did socially with those two households, too, because, they weren't happy. But now, when they realized what we were doing, now they're really into us. And actually, one of the families, they're hobby gardeners themselves. When they realized they had, like, a permaculturist working out here, a horticulturist, a bunch of engineers, you know, and they're all, two of the, you know, people are also chefs, you know, like they just flipped out. Now they're just like, can we come talk to you and get some advice? And like, please, you know. So went from having probably one of my worst neighborhood enemies ever to having a really good friend. George is a good guy, and him and his wife are really cool, and turned into really nice neighbors, actually, after all that I did, you know.
In spite of the parties. So, I love large gatherings of people. You were having a festival, is what you were having.
I had 8 of them over the course of 3 years, and none of them were under 150 people.
Right.
With tents, and I had vendors, I had glass blowers, a tattoo artist came out, I've had like restaurants come out here. The local brewery would give us kegs for it, and then they'd usually bring their family and come and hang, and always a lot of bands. Where my farm is now, actually, the building that the farm is in, it used to have a stage that I built in there, and we get, on average, about 200 people inside of that building. The festival, that people would roam anyway, so like it would never be full, but it was fun.
How long have you been at this location?
I've been here 5 years.
5 years?
5 years roughly. About that.
And so,
a little bit over.
And I know you haven't had the business that long, so when you moved there, you weren't really planning on this business.
No. I swear this place has some old energy, because this is a cool story, how I found the place. I had just gone through my divorce, and my ex and me, when we split, I had the kids the bulk of the time, and I went and got an apartment in town, and we had a place, it was a town away, and I used to have to drive down the highway that this property's on every day to go from her place, my old place, to my new place, the apartment. And I was working shift work at the mill at the time, and I kept driving by this property, and I just loved the house and loved the look of the place. It always caught my eye. And then one day there was a sign up.
Oh, my God.
That house, 13 rooms rent to own, or for rent, and the place falling apart. And I grew up, you know, basically restoring old homes, so this was, like, you know, perfect. So I called the guy, and he was here mowing the lawn at the time. It was like noon on a Thursday. So he told me to come back and hang out. So I got the tour of the property and house. It took 3 hours. He hadn't lived in it in a couple years. It was like raccoons and squirrels ran out when we went in. It was full of junk and falling apart. Yeah, it was insane. And so I loved it. And I'm like, hey, here, how about this? I don't pay a deposit. You cover materials. My deposit will be that I fix this up so that we can move in. And then I want to rent to own, and I will ultimately fix this house up the way it was back in 1906 when it was built. And he was 73. He pretty much ran out of energy on trying to do something with the place, and him and his wife already moved to a new house. So it kind of was just like I was his perfect candidate to take it over. And then within 6 months, just being there, my art and my writing picked up, and the farming idea just, it hit me, you know, just hit me when I was in the house. Just like, you kind of, there's a lot of old energy here. I have a feeling that Illinois and Indiana, they're going to be picking up. They're big hot spots right now as far as, you know, the counterculture of where things are moving. And I have a feeling that I'm on a hot spot in our county, because there is a lot of people come here to this house and tell me all kinds of crazy stuff that they see, feel, hear. And, I mean, like I had when I first got the place, ghost hunters asked to come back. I invited them out because we thought something was going on. Well, you know, cause we didn't live in it yet. Now we were just working on the house, and they asked to return. They came back a couple times because they got such good results. And then I did a bunch of digging on the history. The farm was 200 years old, and it was one of the first settled sites in the region. And this region, it's right, you know, way back when was actually lakefront area. And well, and if you do it, you know, you look at any civilization, especially when you get, you know, back over a couple thousand years ago, waterfront areas were where all your civilizations really thrived. So that's where the agriculture was. And this region was a hotbed of this really, really awesome Native American culture. And much like where you live, you know, if I'm right, you're down by the mounds, aren't you?
No, I'm really not. I'm pretty much flat country. The mounds are, well, the mounds are to the west and south of me.
Oh, okay. I thought you were closer to them. But it's still Illinois in general carries a lot of that energy, and I'm finding so does Indiana. I have so many friends just tell me, like, oh, my God, things are really popping lately. And we look at the properties, and we start looking into the history, and they all have the same variables. And so, like, this place, I feel kind of was waiting for this to happen. You know, so much has happened on this property outside of the farm. We got, you know, I mean, like, the people that come here to work and stay and get the projects that come out of this place.
Yeah, I have to visit because you have invited me and I'm going to do it.
Yeah, you need to.
I do. No, but it was waiting for you because when you get that kind of a feeling, it's just phenomenal. It's well, it's just a bond. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't fight it. And what was when it really hit me was literally, I mean, the house was noisy. You know, there's activity was insane, crazy things, all kinds of stuff going on. And the day he gave me the keys and said, the house is yours, you could just feel the air just drop and get cozy. And everything calmed down. And it was quiet.
Oh.
And everything settled out. And then, like, just incredible things started happening to everyone around us. And I'm talking just, it's insane, you know, like.
But that makes sense because spirits and entities, I mean, they don't always know what's going to happen, and they were agitated too because they.
Oh, yeah.
And so once they actually knew you were going to be sane, then they just calmed down because they could tell how you felt about the place. So.
It was kind of like we think it had a lot to do with the children. Had a lot to do with the activities in the house, the kind of people that were coming around. There was a lot of weird, dark energy before we got there. There was a lot of things that went on that it was like people were attempting to dabble in that realm, weren't doing it right. And so things got left open.
Okay.
Things got left pissed off. And I know how to walk into a place like that, and I have several friends that do, so we did. And, you know, we basically just calmed the place down and you know, followed our instincts to what was right to do there. And, you know, that's what we're doing now. And it's funny, like, the place, it's got such a positive air about it. Anyone sensitive that comes here will tell me immediately that know nothing about the place. They'll tell me the ghosts that still are here and how happy they are. There's two of them, old girl and an old man. The old man built the place 200 years ago, the first building, you know, like it was his farm. And one of my friends that came through was literally told that I was supposed to get this place.
Uh-huh.
And like, I'm supposed to do, like, the things that are coming out of here, you know, the Society for Sustainable Living that we put together,
mm-hmm.
All the projects, my farm, everything. Like, this place was supposed to be what it is, a kind of gathering point for everyone. It's a big house, you know, and I got tons of room, and people, like right now, I'm sitting out in the car, and there's a guy that came to hang out here for the weekend, just showed up a little while ago, and we just, 3 carloads of people just left, you know? Yeah, it's like a traffic zone. I'm not even involved in this. This is just the other people that live in the house having people over doing things, you know? And tomorrow, a bunch of people are meeting here, and then they're taking off to go to a beekeeping class, and, like, I mean, it's just, it's like it's one of the hubs that are starting to blossom out here, and, there's a few, and we're all working together. You know, we're trying to do this together, and I don't think it's me. I think it's the property. I think it's the energy that's here. Everyone feels it when they come here. I don't have to be here for them to feel it, you know. So I just think I was the facilitator. I was the one that knew how to get the right people, had a good nose for people, you know.
Yeah.
And I know how to fit a house, so, like, I was able to make the thing workable. You know, and
you mentioned the Society for Sustainable Living. This is on Facebook also. It's Northwestern,
yes.
Indiana. So that's NWI, Society,
yeah,
for Sustainable Living.
Yes.
Would
and
you tell us a little
go ahead.
About that?
Yeah, it's, it's kind of complicated. We, it's basically every possible change that should happen in society. We've gone after with this group, from healthy living, you know, to teaching people meditation, yoga. We have acupuncturists, massage therapists, people who practice Reiki, everything involved with us. We have several farmers that are big into medicinal herbs, organic heirloom farm, permaculture. We do permaculture classes out of here. Well, like I said, like beekeeping, bushcraft, anything and everything that could get people off the system. We also started up the Time Bank, Northwest Indiana Time Bank, which is a modern-day bartering system with its own database. And, you know, basically everyone trades hour for hour their time. You put in odd hours into work into the Time Bank, you know, that's the... You know, the property is used for, amongst other businesses and things. And then you could, like here, for instance, it's probably better to explain this. Our first transaction was one of the farmers, she needed an oil change. So she plugged in her whole resume of everything she could do, you know, put her thing in her request, I need an oil change. And she immediately got a reply from a younger fellow that hangs out here who was able to put that in. So she now owes the time he put into the Time Bank,
right,
by working on her. It's now in the database. The Time Bank owes him, let's say, 2 hours of time. So now he is owed 2 hours of...
From anybody.
Got 2 hours banked
whenever.
Up, yes.
Whenever he needs something, I mean, and
exactly.
So these, the Time Bank, it can mean, I mean, anything. Somebody may have, like, massages to offer.
Mm-hmm. Everything.
You know, just everything. And what a way to build a community.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. Like, the place, this whole, we have more and more people showing up to do this and are interested in this. We've been invited to talk everywhere about it, and this is not a new idea. Obviously, it goes way, way back. You know, I mean, that was the original, way to, move goods around. But in modern times, the first official, full-on time bank, I believe, was in California, and it was done in, 1984. And then it waned off, the 90s kind of tricked everyone into thinking things were cool. And then we got back into going, oh, my God, we can't operate on this kind of system. We have to find ways around this. And I think it sparks up when the economy goes bad. So right now there's the one we modeled ourselves after is in Dane County, Wisconsin. We really liked their model. So they've been operating, I believe, for 11 years now. And we just mimicked it. I mean, there's no rocket science here. We didn't come up with anything new. We just went and signed up. We actually are using the National Time Banks database system. We sent them, went, and I think it was $50. You can get their whole everything. And you got their resources and all this and experience and people. And we modeled everything after that, and then we took and looked at the one that we thought was the most integral to how we are community-wise, which was Dane County up in Wisconsin. It's a college town, lots of arts, and lots of urban, suburban, and rural communities. So, it was a good mix, just like we are. And so we just kind of copied what they did. And we just started this thing, so we've been building that, nice and slow. But that all came out of that, too, out of that group. Just kind of doing everything we can to get people into alternative living, getting off of what we've been taught was the norm, all the way down to, natural architecture, urban farming, keeping livestock in the city, you name it, where we are teaching it.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, do you use solar power right now?
No, not yet, but that is on the horizon. I had to pick and choose my battles because I got quite a few.
Yeah.
The farm will ultimately, we had developed a bunch of different power generating systems for the farm. Patent pending style stuff it was more compact and used what was the way that we had designed our the actual system, and I'm kind of put the whole creating power on the property off until we build this new building, and then that'll be our next phase, is to go and we'll go straight to solar because it's the easiest to work with, it's the most available. And then we're going to go into our actual power production designs. And that's when I'll probably start working on getting all the buildings on the property, at least over to solar power to start. And I still want to stay tied into the grid. I'm a firm believer in the grid and not getting off-grid, mainly because you have neighbors, and if everybody's supporting each other, then what's the point having a power production facility in that town? Instead of running and hiding, I want to give them solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really big on, I want to make this place one of the highest power production facilities in the region that is a homestead. So we can maybe help all the neighbors surrounding us also end up getting at least on solar.
Yeah.
And putting that power back in the grid, because ultimately what we could do is maybe not need to look into resources like, fossil fuels or nuclear, power production. There's a whole town in Germany that's solar powered, and it's powered by all the homes.
Maybe 3 or 4 months, I'm not sure, one Saturday in Germany, they hooked up all their solar plants, and they actually used only solar power for the whole country that day, and it worked.
I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Now, I could have told you wrong. It was either 60%. I don't want to get this confused. Either 60% of the country went on that solar that day, or the whole country. I mean, that was just a Saturday. They hooked them together just to see what they could do. And Germany and Spain has been beautiful. If you've seen that, I'm a fan of crop circles, and I saw this picture, and it made me think of crop circles, but it's not. It's a solar plant in Spain that it's a spiral.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about. Yeah, that one's beautiful. It does, and it does have that crop circle kind of feel to it, and it's,
yeah, but it's
all panels.
God. So other countries are really doing. I talked with a friend in Pakistan who is very, very interested. I mean, he's following everything and trying to get some things going there in the solar realm. And
nice.
So, you know, yeah, definitely. It's not just, you know, a few people in this country.
It's tricky out there, too, just because all the turmoil to keep equipment on the ground, you know, like that's because I've been looking into it real heavy. When we go to take the next phase on the farm, which is not national expansion, it's international expansion, I want to go into, you know, hunger-striven places and drop farms out there like this, you know, literally just drop them in place and set them up and produce clean water and power and food
have
for
you
people.
Have you been dealing with some other country, talking to somebody there, I mean, about this?
We've been asked to go to Africa already. That was last, I turned it down last year. It was Ghana that we were supposed to go, and we just weren't ready.
Yeah.
But
no,
I started doing research on it, though, for sure.
Ghana is one of the most stable nations in Africa, and I don't say that just because I'm Ghanaian, but it is. It's a very stable, you know, there's a lot going on in Africa, but I would say as soon as you can, you know.
Oh, we want to. Like, I'm actually working on trying to get some to happen by next year. Amongst the, you know, within my mission to raise money for this, I'm also making all my contacts for doing projects like that and expansion projects. And that's part of what I'm doing is trying to get to that next phase and be ready for it. It's part of our giant, you know, our full plan was that we're able to basically build a farm that'll feed the village, power the village, produce clean water for the village, and you know, it's something that sustains itself, has no waste out, it's fully automated, so the high tech parts we can run from out here. We would have a full-on hub that can run every farm we build. And so they would just need laborers, but we can ultimately keep the automation right. We can, you know, keep an eye on things. So if they're confused as to why something's going south on them, we would have the data in front of us, and we could tell them, you know, oh, hey, you're dealing with this, you know, instead of having to fly out there, we could do hands-on work from remote locations.
Yeah.
And it's
my God, yeah.
I was involved in setting up my water treatment plant at the steel mill. I was involved in the project of developing that idea and getting that to happen. And we got a good chunk of it happening. It was a lot simpler than I thought, but that was when that's what sparked the idea to make these farms do that. And then, you know, I got some really smart partners, and so my confidence that we could do it was pretty high, and it seems like it's going pretty good. So, you know, I mean, when we get to the app phase, I think we'll be able to do it very well, and you know, with a good secure system, so like no one can mess with it. But
right.
I guess in the grand scheme, like I was going on Pakistan with the solar panels, was there's regions where you put a panel on a building, and if you're not standing out there guarding it, it'll end up on a hut running a light bulb within a month. I know this for a fact because I had a friend that happened to. You know, it happens out here in, like, Detroit, Gary, places like that. Like, you literally, you can't go in lighthearted on these ideas. You have to go in full force, kind of like growing distractionary crop for deer. You can't fight what's going on out there. But
right.
You can still implement the idea, but you just have to do it at a large enough scale to where it can't get overrun by, you know, people in dire situations that'll take whatever they can get, you know.
Yeah.
And you can't blame them for that, you know. In a situation like what's going on,
Right.
You want your family to be warm. You want your family fed. You need things. So it's not about the hooligans robbing, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, you can't fault those people, but it's, like you said, you've got to do it on a large enough scale.
Well, that was you'll like this, too. This is why we started the farm. We needed to create a cash cow, so I wasn't bound to banks and the government to get money to do all my big, crazy humanitarian project ideas.
Right.
The bulk of the partners, we came together. It wasn't just by technical capabilities. It was because we had this social agenda that was kind of gargantuan. And we realized that this thing, you know, using some what I would call ugly models out there, but making good versions of them as far as how corporations work.
Yeah.
We could really make a lot of money and turn around, and we wrote it into our business plan that we had to donate or at least fund projects that were community-based. So, like, the company will worry about expansion, and the shareholders, the owners, you know, the partners, have to basically take, you know, a very large chunk. Like, I think we put in a third. I don't even remember right now because I haven't seen profit yet. So, like, I forgot what I should make. But we're supposed to take a third of it and put it into social community projects.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the idea behind this was, everyone had kind of these things that they wanted to do. Mine was to basically start the Sustainable Living Society and fund eco-villages and anyone that's out there doing research and trying to live in an alternative lifestyle. So, and I wanted to take what they've done and help them actually plug some actual data out there for people to see, you know, so that we can make it readily available, more accessible, not so daunting, you know. And so that was where I wanted to put my money. And, you know, a couple of the other partners, they wanted to go and get into third world countries and help develop these towns and villages and get them to where they are in, you know, just better shape in general, you know.
Yeah. On their government or ours, because that's a horrible place to be. I want to mention also, we didn't. You do have a blog at KWITHROW Tales, TALES, .blogspot.com. And you may not be doing so much writing now, but you have in the past written a lot.
Yeah.
And,
I've got, actually there was quite a bit, even unpublished. I have 5 half done novels in my computer right now that I'm actually turning around and getting back into.
Half done. Okay, Ken. Yeah, maybe finish.
I have to. They're all half done, and it was weird. They came from a different part of my life.
Yeah.
And, things have changed for me, you know, in the last couple of years, and I'm realizing the ideas are very embryonic of things I'm getting now. And so, like, I think why they never could be finished was because the inspiration was half-baked. So, like, all my short stories made it out. You know, I used to do a lot of articles and journalistic stuff, and I used to paint book covers. So, like, there's, you know, an illustration books and things, and so, like, all, you know, when I was into that, it was there, but I was more in, like, the horror sci-fi market. I did some children's book stuff, but the bulk of my writing was very I would say, like, if Hunter S. Thompson and William Burroughs fell in a blender, that would be the closest description, I guess. And then I had a good knowledge base of the things that I get now, but it was very dark because it came from what was entertaining me, which was a lot of horror and science fiction, and, you know, there's good stuff in there, but it just, why I couldn't get to the next phase of my ideas and I was just really caught up too much in it.
And life has a way of putting you where you need to be. And
I was just going to say that, where you need to be.
Yeah.
It kind of cracks your skull open when you're ready for it. And
I
a lot of the things that, like the things I put on that blog right there, those couple short stories, were just, you know, kind of like, here's my writing style. This is the weird crap I'm into, but it was still like, you know, a lot of my personality's in there, but I have a lot more that I wanted to say with a lot more depth and meaning while still keeping in that envelope of weirdness that I really enjoy. And so I, you know, I had started all these novels, and they get to a point and then they just hit a wall. There's no inspiration, and
you know,
now they're back.
Even if you never finished them, I mean, they served a purpose. And
they did. They exercised. They gave me exercise, you know, they gave me a way to stretch my literary muscle a little bit, you know, and develop a rhetoric, you know.
You know, nothing that we ever write and put out to the universe or that we say, it's never lost.
No, it's not.
Oh, even if it's not, quote unquote, finished, then, well, it served a purpose too. And
oh, yeah.
To be. But you know what? I've got to let you go. Ken, this was wonderful, and I do want you to come back. Like you were saying, www.greenfarmsanm.com, and I'll put these that you mentioned on the Aramarte Fio page on Facebook and other places. And anyway, my friend, thank you so very much. You are a fountain of knowledge.
Oh, geez, that was nice.
Well, you know so much. And so we'll have you back, okay?
I would love to. Yeah, this is a blast. I love doing this.
All righty. Thank you. And have a wonderful weekend. Don't forget to set your clock up.
Oh, God, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow night or Sunday morning, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Hang in there for Mercury Retrograde. 10 more days. Good.